Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight's topic of discussion is the work of Alfred Hitchcock. Joining me tonight are Sammy Giuliano. Say hello.
Hello.
And Cindy Collins-Smith. Say hello.
Hello.
Now, we were supposed to be joined by Aaron White, but unfortunately events are such that he can't join us, but I will be adding in some notes that he sent my way when possible. So, you know, Hitchcock is undeniably one of the great directors, one of the most influential directors of all time. Definitely one of my favorites in some ways, and maybe not so much as a person. We can get into that, maybe. My wife and I were actually talking about that earlier tonight. She's like, "You got to talk about what happened on the sets," and I was like, "Oh, well, don't worry, we'll get into that." You know. But as a creative talent, yeah, he's one of the best. Did a hell of a lot of movies over a very long period. So I usually like to ask this question to start out, and I think ladies first. So I'll start with you, Cindy. How did we first come to Hitchcock?
You know, it's funny, I saw that question, and I know that you always ask that, but I was like, how do I answer this question? Because usually I can answer the question, and this time I can't, because I cannot remember a time when I did not know who Alfred Hitchcock was. Literally. I mean, I was a kid growing up in the 60s, and my first memory of a title of a Hitchcock film was on the playground as a kid when The Birds aired on television and my friends were all talking about it. I didn't see it because I had a bedtime. But it was the first title that I remember people talking about, but I already knew who Hitchcock was. So, you know, the answer is I really don't know. He was just everywhere. He was ubiquitous. This was the 60s, and he was everywhere. So that's how I came to Hitchcock. He was just in the air.
You know, I'm very similar. I think my introduction to Hitchcock, honestly, it could have been through Alfred Hitchcock Presents, because, you know, back in the 80s, when I was a little kid, when I was younger, because I'm in my early 40s, that was being shown on different stations. Hell, I think Nick at Night had it for a while. A&E, I think, might have had it. So it's very possible that, you know, 5, 6 years old, the first Hitchcock thing I ever saw was an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. But just like you, I'm not sure what movie it would have been. I'm pretty sure it wasn't Psycho, but it's possible it could have been Rear Window or The Birds. You know, it could have been something else that I just wasn't aware at the time was a Hitchcock, you know, because we watched a lot of older black and white movies, so it's very possible that maybe I watched something like Saboteur or, you know, anything of that era. I mean, hell, I could have seen Rebecca at 5 years old and not realize that's what I'd see.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what I remember years later when I was about 17, 18, making sure that I'd seen every film that had ever been up for a major Oscar at any point that I could possibly get my hands on. When I came across Rebecca and I marked it off, I said, you know, that seems familiar, but it may just be that it's been so influential and there's lots of books and movies like this, you know, both before and after. But it, you know, who knows? So, yeah, we're much in the same boat. I'll be interested to hear what Sammy has to say. So, what about you, Sammy?
Well, you hit on two of the film and television that are part of my answer. I first came across Hitchcock from Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which was on Channel 5. And I watched them I was maybe 10 years old, around 1964. I watched them, and you know, that was my first actual introduction to anything that Hitchcock had done. But of course, that segued in that decade and beyond with seeing Rebecca for the first time on a big screen in a college class. In my first year of college, they had American feature films and they showed Rebecca. So that was actually the first big screen viewing of Rebecca. I had watched Psycho for the first time on television. And getting back to Alfred Hitchcock Presents, that went into Alfred Hitchcock Hour. And, you know, great stuff like An Unlocked Window, which I didn't see until years later. But it was basically Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Then there was a book series called Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators, which ironically enough was written by Robert Arthur, who went on to write some episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Boris Karloff's Thriller. And, you know, that series launched in maybe the mid-60s, and then Arthur died in, I think, 1969, and several other writers took over that series. But Hitchcock did an introduction to every one of those books. There's 43 in the series, five different authors. And he would talk about the three boy investigators, and, you know, he would give his usual wry humor in there. And I was looking at that at the time. So Hitchcock was all around us. He was on television. He was in the theater. He was revered in the college classes. And, of course, he had his imprint on children's books, adolescent books, which are still popular and still sell very well on eBay.
Can I ask a question here?
Sure.
Because one of my memories is the night before I turned 10 years old, I was in a hair salon getting my hair done. My mom took me down there to get my hair cut. And it was a long wait, and there were some sort of mystery true crime publications sitting on the table, and that's what I picked up and started reading. And my memory, now this may be an incorrect memory, so I'm going to ask Sammy if it is correct. What I picked up, it was basically true crime. Did Hitchcock do anything along those lines? Because my memory is that it was a Hitchcock production.
He was involved with that, yeah. There were actually comics that, you know, true crimes, and that Hitchcock was woven into that. I'm not that familiar enough to tell you what they were specifically, but your recollection is correct. Hitchcock was Hitchcock's imprint was on those as well, and they basically took some of his old stories and they incorporated into the comic renditions. So he was there too. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
You know, this reminds me, and I just want to, I'm not going to say much more because I usually wait until later, but we will be having an episode coming up later this month focusing on his television work, on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Alfred Hitchcock Hour, all that good stuff. Mostly Alfred Hitchcock Presents, but, you know, that is coming up, guys. So, you know, if you two want in on that, let me know. But I was going to say, Sammy, you know, we were, and Cindy, we were, this reminds me a bit, too. You know, there was Boris Karloff's Thriller, and they made a comic out of that. And that basically just used his face and didn't have his input, whereas the show actually did have his input. I do wonder if the comics, which I have found some files online in certain peg legs places, they are not good, but I can only imagine that something that Hitchcock actually had a hand in would have been good. So,
yeah.
No, that's just a random thought from me.
The Three Investigators, by the way, are very good, though. They were very good. The Three Investigators.
So, you know, this is where Aaron will come in for having, being here but not being here. My next question is going to be, what themes does Hitchcock have. And Aaron said, you know, it's in as much as he has one, Aaron felt that it was the chaos that bad sexual appetites cause, and blondes. But, you know, the films are really more about tone and mood than thematic explorations. And I have to say, I do agree with that. I really do think that while, you know, there are some very light themes, that it really is more an exploration of tone, mood, style. And let's be honest, there's some darkly funny shit in Hitchcock's work. Some of them films would have been unbearable without that dark levity. So, Sammy, what do you think about this? What are your thoughts on themes in Hitchcock?
Well, everywhere that you look, without even attempting to research, just your own hands-on experience with Hitchcock and knowing even just a little about his work, it always comes down to that one word, obsession. Always that one word. Everyone that talks about Hitchcock's theme, right away they jump in with that one, obsession. Obviously, the films that have obsession are clear and that we know what they are. And that's, you know, that's a theme that he goes explores numerous times in a number of his films. You know, taking it more a subplot of that, you know, we see, for example, in Rear Window, voyeurism, and in other films, you know, obviously he examines death, and as you mentioned before, you know, it's black humor also. I mean, for example, in what's probably the most celebrated Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode of them all, and now we're jumping into influences because I'm mentioning Roald Dahl here. We'll probably talk about him later again. But anyways, that, you know, Lamb to the Slaughter was probably the most famous. Doesn't necessarily have to be everybody's favorite one, in fact, but it's probably the most celebrated one. And there's the black humor and the death. But then, of course, we saw it further and later in his career, even in Frenzy. You know, there's authority, there's sexuality that you mentioned, there's guilt, there's the wrong man. All of these themes come into play when we talk about Hitchcock. But now I'm kind of like hogging all of the potential candidates. But I just wanted to just mention them, and then maybe we'll expound later further on it.
And like I said, I think Sammy that you definitely need to be on the Alfred Hitchcock Presents show. There's no way you're not going to be on it. I'm going to have to drag you and tie you to a chair for that one.
Boris Karloff's Thriller is my main one, but I love Hitchcock Presents as well.
Thank you, you know that one's coming up in the fall, so don't worry about that. Cindy, what are your thoughts on themes in Hitchcock?
Well, obviously what you guys said, you know, obsession and obsession is one of the key ones, the sexual, you know, tweakedness, you know, the weird repressions and all of that kind of stuff. All of that's very key. The wrong man theme where, you know, the wrong man is being pursued. I mean, that comes up over and over and over again. Or sometimes just the ordinary person getting caught up in a big plot that, you know, shouldn't involve them, but it does. Those are some of the key things that you see. But I think that one of the things that Hitchcock himself talked about as being a key thing for him is the chase. And maybe we can talk about that as a technical thing, because he really has an entire theory of the chase and the role of the chase in film, and not just film, but fiction in general. He kind of believed that every plot was a chase of some sort, chase being defined as either a pursuit of a goal or in antiphonal motion trying to escape,
I think that's interesting that he would want to define it like that, because, you know, that's just a different definition of, you know, search or quest or desire. I forget who said it. There was some writing guru, and the name escapes me right now, and I'll probably feel like an idiot when I realize who it was, but he said, it doesn't matter what you do with your characters, you have to have them at some point have a real desire in your story, even if it's just for a cup of water.
Yeah, and Hitchcock did not define it specifically in terms of a literal chase. You know, obviously that comes up frequently in his films. You know, you have some incredible pursuits, and I think his first really, really great chase, although he would probably say that The Entire Lodger is a chase, but I think that his first really great chase sequence is in Number 17, which is not a good film, but it's got a great, incredible chase in it. But I'm trying to see what the name of the thing is. I think it's just called The Chase, The Core of the Film, or something like that. The Core of the Film, The Chase. Yeah, The Core of the Movie, The Chase. This is in Hitchcock on Hitchcock, which is Selected Writings. He wrote this in 1950, and it's in the section on Thrill, Suspense, The Audience. And, you know, it's really interesting because he ultimately defines pretty much every plot in terms of chase, and you redefined that in terms of other things. Hitchcock likes to think in terms of chase, though. And so I find that very interesting to kind of look at where the chase is. Like in The Ring, you have, you know, the chase is these two men after this one girl, you know, so you have the love triangle situation, which can be, you know, styled as a chase. Things like that.
Yeah, I mean, even in, you know, Psycho, you have the people looking for Marion, and they don't know she's dead yet. So
right.
It's a search for Marion. They're kind of chasing after her.
Yeah, and Marion is literally in flight, you know.
Right. Right. I mean, you. But it's interesting. You know, you mentioned The Lodger. I just have to say, and I'm sure we'll get into this later, but that's a movie I respect without loving. That's just one of those movies that I respect the hell out of it, but I've never been able to fully embrace it.
We will definitely talk about The Lodger later. Believe me.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure it's on most people's top 10 list. Hell, it might even be on mine, but that doesn't mean I love it. You know? So, you know, the next question is going to be, he had, you know, really two eras. He had his British era, and he had his American era, you know, when he came over and did Rebecca, and let's see, does anyone know the other movie he did that year along with Rebecca?
Well, I don't know if he did Waltzes from Vienna that same year, but was there another one after that, after Rebecca?
Yeah, I just wanted to see if anybody knew the...
What the heck was it? Suspicion, was it? That what it was? No, that was 41, right? Suspicion.
Well,
yeah.
I was thinking of Foreign Correspondent.
Oh, okay.
I was thinking of Foreign Correspondent,
right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I actually happen to think Foreign Correspondent is a pretty decent movie. In some ways, I think it's a better film than Rebecca. But we can definitely get into that later.
It's certainly more what we think of as Hitchcock, you know, than Rebecca is.
Yes, and I like Rebecca a lot. I mean, I think Rebecca is one of his finer films. The people that say, "Oh, it's a Selznick movie," you know, yeah, but it's also a Hitchcock. It's got so much that's Hitchcock. I mean, it does elements of Gaslight better than Gaslight did it.
I love Gaslight though.
so do I. I mean, I think Gaslight's a classic. Don't get me wrong.
Gaslight scares the crap out of me.
Well, you know. But I'm not sure anybody's as scary as that lady and, oh, my God, and Rebecca.
Well,
oh.
But
that actor
context,
also did a hell of a job there.
The context for my comment about Gaslight is that I saw Gaslight right after I got engaged. So now you understand
why. Well, if you'd seen a double bill of Rebecca and Gaslight right after getting engaged or shortly after getting married, that would be terrifying, I'm sure. That would be terrifying. But, yeah, you know, our next question is going to be, do we prefer his British or his American eras? And, you know, it's pretty simple. Aaron and I were talking about this, and we really do agree that, you know, it's the American. Now, I think Aaron had an interesting point that it was really late in the British era where he figures it out, but he took that to America and thrived until pretty much the fall of the code. So I wanted to know what you two thought, and I'll go with you, Sammy. So
I don't think there's any question. The American era blows away the British era in volume and quality. Some of the greatest films of all time from any director, Vertigo, Rear Window, Psycho, it's not even close. It's a blowaway. However, it should be mentioned that his British period, as you noted, did start to really take off the last few years before he came into Hollywood to do Rebecca. And we did get the likes of The Lady Vanishes, which was the only British film that will intrude in my top 10 when we get to that. And then The 39 Steps is justly famous. And then he went back to Britain late in his career to do Frenzy. What's that? Oh, I'm sorry.
I said Lady Vanishes is a film I'm quite fond of. I tried showing it to my wife a few months back, and she just couldn't get into it, which, you know, it was disappointing. But, you know, you can't love all the same films. But that's such a fun little movie.
And then you mentioned the larger British film as well, which nearly made my top 10. And then I think Sabotage and The Man Who Knew Too Much was particularly good. And Blackmail and Young and Innocent, all of these are, you know, quality films. You know, so he did have, in other words, if he never came to America and his career ended in 1940, while he would not be, as he's considered now, one of the two or three greatest directors in the history of the medium, and some people think he's number one, he would still be an important film luminary just based on his British period. Those were great films, quality films. But when you play them one against the other, and I don't know what Cindy's going to say, but to me, it's not even a contest, and I'll stop at that point.
Yeah, Cindy, your turn.
Okay. I agree with what you guys said, but I would like to make a lot of caveats about the British period. I think it is absolutely true that the American output is much higher quality than anything he was able to do in the British period. And part of that has to do with just simply learning his craft, knowing his craft, and all of that. But there are some other things that are very, very – I'm sorry?
Let's not forget that he went to Germany and spent time at UFA.
Yes. Yes. But one of the things that I think we have to consider is that in Britain, there were a lot of constraints placed upon him in his filmmaking. He, after the success of The Lodger, and The Lodger was a humongous success. I mean, when Bioscope first reviewed it in September of 26, they said it is possible that this film is the finest British production ever made. You know, and they were right, because Hitchcock was the first British filmmaker who really saw the film as an artistic medium, as a medium that was, you know, viable in its own right, and the industry around him did not see that. He got a lot of that, as you said, from, you know, his trip to Germany, and he learned a lot in Germany, but there were a lot of constraints placed upon him. First of all, he had to film a lot of stage plays, you know, which he hated doing. And it's kind of funny, because I think Juno and the Paycock is a good film, but Hitchcock hated it, because it's like, where is there to go when you've got this great script by, you know, Sean O'Casey, right? I mean, where is there to go? You've got this incredible script already. He just didn't feel like he could put his mark on it. And so that was actually something that happened to him a lot in those early years. It wasn't until The Man Who Knew Too Much that he really broke free of a lot of those constraints and started making the movies he wanted to make. So you have that. You have budget issues. You have quality of film stock. All of those issues play into the British output. And then he comes to America, and you immediately see the difference with Rebecca when he has a budget, when he has beautiful film stock and a great cinematographer. You know, so it's and then, of course, Rebecca makes his mark in America. He's able to ultimately buy, you know, I think it's by the mid-40s, pretty much control his own career. And, you know, after that, it's like all bets are off because Hitchcock is able to become Hitchcock. But a lot of it, you have to consider the British output in terms of all the constraints that were on him, in addition to the fact that, you know, the American output, he had the budgets to do what he wanted to do, and he had the creative freedom to do what he wanted to do for the most part. Rebecca, not so much, because it was a Selznick picture, but, you know, he was able to make his mark with it and get his name out there with it. And his name was already out there from his British output, but that made it even higher, you know, because, I mean, he's now the director.
I mean, there was a reason that Selznick offered him the deal that he did to come to the United States and make and make movies for a few years. Which, of course, turned into, what, the 3-4 decades?
Yeah.
So,
and
you know,
I agree, by the way, with what Sammy said. You also have to consider Frenzy, you know, as part of the British output. So it does tip the balance a little bit more in favor of British, although I still think the American output overall, you know, beats the British output. And that it's not really close, although Frenzy does make it a lot closer.
Yeah, but, you know, I would probably have to say, if we're going to answer the, you know, the question itself, I probably would have to say I prefer the American, but I do have some films that are in his British period that I really do like The Lady Vanishes, which is in my top 10. Probably sitting right there at 9 or 10, but I like it quite a bit. It's a heck of a little movie. So we talked a little bit here about what's going to be the topic of our next question, and that is influences. Now, Aaron had said that he thought, you know, German Expressionists and Pulp Fiction works. I don't think he's wrong, but, you know, I was thinking about especially the German Expressionism, because Aaron just mentioned that today, but I've been thinking about that, you know, for a long time in the lead-up to this show tonight. And I have to say, you know, I think in some ways I've read people talk, you know, say on Facebook and other places, and I've heard some critics and historians talk about how he's reminiscent of Long, maybe in some ways, but when you look at something like The Lodger is much less Long, and in some ways it's more Murnau or even, and this may be funny to people that aren't as familiar with his silent work, and I'm talking here visually, but Ernst Lubitsch, there's actually some very Lubitsch influences there as well. There's some other directors that Germany had at the time, but those are the ones that pop immediately to mind as having an influence on Hitchcock in terms of pulp novels. Hell, that's basically anyone. I know Hitchcock said he wished he'd gotten the chance to do Double Indemnity. So, and Wilder supposedly said, yeah, well, tough shit. So,
wow, that would be very interesting to see side by side a Hitchcock version and a Wilde version of that.
Yeah, Totally different films. Totally different films. I'm sure Chandler would have still claimed Hitchcock drove him to drink too, because anything was going to drive him back to drink. So Cindy, we'll go with you. What do you think some of his influences were?
Okay, I'm going to talk more cinematics than thematics here, because I think, you know, obviously Pulp Fiction is a big influence on his thematics. But cinematically, I think without question, his biggest influences were silent cinema and particularly Murnau. What Hitchcock really wanted to do all the time, I mean, this goes all the way to Frenzy, is he wanted to tell purely cinematic stories. But, you know, obviously you have to do sound by the time we get to sound cinema. But he wanted, his big obsession was to do the last laugh, you know, and he never got to do it. But, and that is a story that's told without any title cards. You know, it's
right.
you're reading over the shoulder of the characters. He's telling the story visually, and that was Hitchcock's big goal in The Lodger. He wanted to do that, and actually Ivor Montague edited the film down so that he did it more than he originally did it, because in the original version it was littered with title cards. Ivor Montague noticed that he was actually more cinematically oriented than textually oriented, and edited the title cards down in a way that made Hitchcock's movie even better. So I think that I really don't think it's even a question that cinematically he would have told you that Murnau and silent film were his biggest influences. And there's that great scene in Frenzy where you see the camera go down the hallway to the door of the murderer, you know, and then after they go into the room, the camera pulls back to the street. And he not only incorporates the camera movement, but he also deals with sound and silence, because you have the street noise, and then it goes to the door and becomes silent at the door. And then it pulls back in the hallway from silence back to sound. And so, cinematically, I think that would be, even though there's sound in it, that would be definitely a tribute to the silent cinema, where he's trying to tell the story visually and give you that impression that this girl's now being murdered right now. Because you've already seen one murder, so you don't need to see a second one. He's letting you imagine it.
Yeah. No, it's you know, and that's the thing. You know, that's why, you know, like I said in the lead up, I said, well, we all know, but I said specifically which directors, and those are the two that and especially Murnau, those are the two that really, really stuck out. I was like, he's absolutely trying to do what Murnau was doing, at least visually, because, you know, they're both such great visualists.
I'm sorry. I was just wondering if I could add one thing. He actually knew Murnau in Germany and learned storyboarding from him. So he actually literally learned a lot of film technique from his time in Germany with Murnau while Murnau was making The Last Laugh.
Excuse me. So, Sammy, your thoughts?
Well, everybody covered it. I would only say that arguably Luis Buñuel is another director who Hitchcock greatly admired and was influenced by, particularly by Gian Andalou, which came into play when Salvatore Dali worked on Spellbound. And Hitchcock is noted in interviews and studies on him to acknowledge Buñuel's early films, the early silent films, and, you know, the surrealism that, you know, manifested itself in Spellbound and to a degree in Vertigo. And Hitchcock was very much interested in that. It makes him very, very versatile, that there were a lot of old cinematic forms that impressed him that he wove into some of his films. I don't doubt it. If I was asked first the most important one, it would have been Murnau in this, but particularly in The Lodger, which is, you know, very, very lyrical. That Murnau lyricism is shown in The Lodger. But I wanted to mention Buñuel because I think that, he also comes into play in this equation.
So now we come to the next side, the flip side. What has his influence been? For me, there's one word, immeasurable. Everything. What hasn't he influenced? You know, editing, sound, costuming, the way stories are told in certain types of movies, the way movies are told basically in general, expectations. There's just so much. We could do a whole show about Hitchcock's influences and make it 3 or 4 hours. So to you, Sammy, what are his major influences? You know, if you could point to a few, what sticks out to you the most?
You want to know what directors that he influenced? De Palma would be the first one that I would think of.
Oh, absolutely. No question. I mean, Jesus, look at
that. And even Obsession was one of the names of one of De Palma's movies. But obviously there's a lot more than just him. To mention De Palma is kind of like cheating because it's like, it's like the reincarnation of Hitchcock. I mean, it's... But there's, you know, obviously,
well, it would be like, you know,
all the heavy hitters, you know, Spielberg, Scorsese, all of them, you know, have over the years have, you know, testified that, you know, that he greatly influenced their work in more ways than one. But,
it would be like trying to say that there's a revelation that the Catholic Church had an influence on Martin Scorsese's filmmaking.
right. That sounds about right. Yeah. But you know, he certainly of all the the directors who have exerted enormous influence, you know, he's sitting just about at the top. If you ask how many masterpieces all these great directors made, you know, arguably he made more masterpieces than any other single director because he was prolific, because he worked on two sides of the Atlantic, that he has so many, you know, films that make lists, Sight and Sound lists, all of the lists among the greatest ever made. There's probably nobody that could really, hold a candle to him in that sense in pure volume. And I'm not – he's not my personal favorite director, but he is certainly high up there.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's yours, Adam.
No.
I don't know if he's your top director.
No, he's up there top 10 or 12. He's amazing.
Yeah.
Cindy.
This is his influence. Your comment about immeasurable is accurate. Let's remember that this is a guy who started in the silent cinema and influenced British film in the silent era. You know, he had an impact on other British filmmakers within the British, you know, system. And he didn't really get a big international showing until The Man Who Knew Too Much in 34, 35. It came to America in 35. You've got that. The whole De Palma thing, you have people copying Hitchcock. My husband reminded me of that terrible Psycho copy.
Oh, Lord, I want to forget about that.
Yeah, you have those things. But at the same time, Hitchcock was a prolific writer about cinema. I mean, he's more prolific in writing about cinema, I think, than Edgar Allan Poe was in theorizing about fiction. And, you know, Poe was an incredibly significant critic in terms of, you know, establishing the short story and all sorts of things like that. I believe that Hitchcock is similar in terms of his own critical output, his discussion of technical issues, what's important in the film. I mean, he is important for, you know, just so many things, including the role of music in cinema, how to use sound, how to use the combination of picture and sound. I mean, he influences basically almost everything in everybody's movies. So, you know, I mean, we have people who are interested in copying the stylistics, but at the same time...
I mean, I just mentioned one person, Martin Scorsese. I mean, look at his stuff. People,
right.
You know, he definitely has some Italian neorealism influences. But there's also undoubtedly Hitchcock influence to the point mm-hmm. that he did a Hitchcock homage with his little short film, The Key to Reserva, not to mention, of course, Shutter Island, which I don't think is a bad film. I don't think it's a great film, but I don't think it's a bad movie.
I like Shutter Island. It was pretty good.
It's a fun little diversion.
I mean, even Mel Brooks, did Hitchcock, you know?
Yeah.
Very, very humorously, I might add. But, But I do think that he's foundational. That's what I would say. That a lot of Hitchcock's work and a lot of Hitchcock's theorizing about how to do cinema is foundational to cinema.
And you know, and part of that is because of when he came around, you know.
Yes.
If everything up to about 1912, 13, 14 was really, you know, protozoic form of cinema, and then everything for the next decade or so was cinema starting to come into its own, Hitchcock came around right around the time cinema started to come into its own and saw it through until the 70s. And I mean, hell, actually, what was it? His last film was 1980, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you had someone that worked in films for well over 50 years, in many decades, on two sides of the Atlantic. You know, in some ways, he is part of what cinema is.
yeah, that's what I would say. That he is we don't have modern cinema without Alfred Hitchcock.
Absolutely not.
And so, you know, I don't really even need to point out specific directors because his influence is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's kind of like what we were saying at the very beginning. We don't remember a time when we didn't know who Alfred Hitchcock was. You know, it's like we have probably never seen very many films that didn't have some aspect of Hitchcock's influence, whether it was the use of the soundtrack or not. You know, I mean, that's also something he theorized about very early on. You know,
well, you know, there was a soap opera years ago, The Edge of Night, and it was written for many years by a well-regarded mystery writer called Henry Slezar. And Henry Slezar was asked by a soap publication one time where he gets his ideas, and he says, "Oh, lots of places. Very often I watch a Hitchcock movie."
Yep.
And that was back in the 50s and 60s, you know.
So it even goes beyond cinema, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, this is a guy who was like a three-time Edgar Award-winning mystery writer. I mean, this you know, and there he is being influenced by Hitch. So the next question is this. What makes a Hitchcock a Hitchcock? And again, this is where Aaron sent some stuff along. And he said this, and I want to read it exactly. Hitchcock once said that you have to play your audience like a piano, and that's his touch. His best films uniformly tickle the nerves until the payoff. And as for that, quote, you must never let the bomb explode, unquote.
That's a great video when he talks about the bomb exploding.
So, Sammy, your thoughts?
Well, there's so many things you could say. I mean, what makes a Hitchcock, his cameos, which we had to talk about at some point in this discussion, you know, his unique cameos. My favorite one is the newspaper across the water in Lifeboat, and they pick up the newspaper and his face is on it. I always laugh at that one. But there's so many other interesting ones. I remember the one in I Confess, and when he walks out of the pet shop and the birds, and carrying the cello case and the strangers on the train. I mean, it got to be where I guess many people who were, it took up studying Hitchcock's films, one of the things they would look at when they, you know, got the film, where is he? They would be waiting the whole movie. Sometimes he would, you know, make his appearance immediately, you know, in the first scene, you know, the first 10 minutes. But then other times it was in the middle of the film or later in the film. So, that, you know, that was one little perk that he gave you all the time. You know, it was funny at the same time. It even made some people, you know, look at the film more intently because they were watching for something. So certainly that makes, you know, that makes Hitchcock a Hitchcock. I mean, but, you know, there's a lot of things that I could add that we've said already or that we will say in answering the other questions. You know, he's unique. You know, he's a, you know, he brought together all the elements, craftsmanship. I mean, even earlier you talked about Rebecca, and, you know, yeah, Rebecca, L'Olivier and Fontaine. But for me, Rebecca was George Barnes and Franz Wachtmann. That was Rebecca to me, you know, the sensory elements of the film. Yeah.
One thing I have to say is he may have coined the term MacGuffin, but he didn't create the idea of what a MacGuffin is. However, what he did is perfect it and perfect its use and understand that style of storytelling, and that the plot is one thing, then there's everything else. And as much as his films are very plot-centric, you don't go and watch a Hitchcock movie, at least I don't, just for the plot. You watch it for everything else. You watch it for those little bits. You watch it for those visual flourishes. You watch it for that damn wonderful dark humor. Because, you know, I mean, you look at something like To Catch a Thief. You look at any of his movies. The Birds, which is not one of my favorites, but has some great stuff at the beginning in the pet shop. I love that stuff. You know, there's just so much great humor in his films, and he when he's on, he has a mix of humor and dark that is hard to match. So, Cindy.
Everything you guys said is true. I'd like to add a couple of things in terms of the origin of Hitchcock's appearances, his little cameos. That actually started, you probably know that the first time he did it was in The Lodger, but the reason he did it in The Lodger was because of the budget. They needed more bodies on the screen. And so he put his own body on the screen, and then it became a thing, which I think is kind of funny because it started out as a practical consideration, and then it became a characteristic of a Hitchcock film. What you said, Adam, about the dark humor, you know, you've mentioned that a couple of times. Hitchcock, actually, what you said earlier about needing that to release the tension, that was actually part of his theories, you know, when he wrote about that was actually literally something he was attempting to do, that you needed to have that balance in order to get the audience to keep coming along. And he even talked about how even in the midst of, you know, a horrible trauma, he liked to incorporate the ordinary, which, you know, you see that in the in the scene where you hear the crowd noises on the street after the you know, coming out back onto the sidewalk in Frenzy, but you also see it in some of the humor in The Man Who Knew Too Much, the original version, where you have that wonderful British humor with, you know, Leslie Banks, whose character is quite fun and eccentric. But for me, I think the key issue with Hitchcock is putting a precedent on visual and auditory, not dialogue, but auditory storytelling, where you have that you're appealing to the senses of the audience rather than just their intellect, rather than just the dialogue and trying to follow the dialogue. He tries to tell as much as he can without dialogue and uses dialogue when he must. So I think that that's another characteristic of Hitchcock's filmmaking that we don't necessarily talk about enough, you know, but it was something that was very important to him. I think he mentioned it in his interview with Truffaut, but he also talked about it a lot in, you know, some of his other writings.
Sammy, was that you? Did you have something to say on this before we move to the next question?
Oh, no, I spoke first on this.
Okay, no, it must have been a noise in the background for you. Then I thought you were saying you had something to say. Okay, nice. Then I will move on to this one, and that is, who was his most important collaborator? Aaron wanted me to send along this: a dead heat between cinematographer Robert Burks and composer Bernard Herrmann. Well, I'll send it back to you, Cindy. Who do you have as his
Bernard
most important
Herrmann.
Collaborator?
I have Bernard Herrmann.
That's mine as well. I mean, Burks is a good choice, but it's Herrmann.
Yeah. I mean, I think he worked with multiple cinematographers, and undoubtedly he also worked with multiple you know, composers, but the one composer who really, you know, made Hitchcock films, and this is actually later on in Hitchcock's career and only for about a decade, is Bernard Herrmann. But his music elevated those films to heights that these films are great films even without the Herrmann score, and then the Herrmann score just sends them into the stratosphere, you know. So
yeah, like Vertigo and
Psycho, North by Northwest.
I'll say this: I did a paper, like a 5 or 8 page paper, or maybe it was a 10. It was a 5 to 10 page paper just on the music in Psycho, for an introductionary music class in college. I took a class called Introduction to Film Music. It was actually really, really a fun class. As a side note, the person that taught that class, he had written the book that he used, and it was a fairly nice little book. He had apparently made friends during the research of the book with the composer Basil Poliduris, who is known, of course, for his thunderous, rapturous score for Conan the Barbarian. And you hear this name, Basil Poliduris, and you're thinking this big, strapping Greek god, like something from a Steve Reeves movie. Well, one day we walk into class, and there's this little gentleman sitting at the piano in the class, and Dr. McDonald is there, and he says, "Okay, class, we have a special guest today. Basil, would you like to introduce yourself?" And Basil Poliduris, in this little Missouri accent, said, "Hey, everyone, I'm Basil. I'm going to talk about my time in movies and music, and if you have any questions, I'm here." What?
You know, it's funny. My parish priest is a big fan of Conan the Barbarian, and he will love that story. loves the music.
So, sorry, I didn't mean to suck the hair out of the room there, but. Sorry, hold on one second. I've got to cough. I'm sorry. I'm going to mute the phone. So where were we before? Because I got sidetracked with that story. I'm sorry. It was too good a story that I couldn't pass up the telling of it.
I think Sammy hasn't talked yet on this question,
yep.
Has
so,
he?
So Sammy, you go.
Well, you know, I think you and I talked enough over the years to know my favorite element of a film is the musical score. I'm a score maniac. I'm a music nut. So I would have answered.
You, a music guy? I don't believe
I would have answered immediately with Herman, but I didn't take your question that way, and I'm certainly free to take your question the way I deem fit. When you spoke about collaborators, I thought right away of Alma Reville, his wife. His collaborator.
Yeah.
And right away, that's the first answer that I would come up with. I'm not thinking of Herman. And I'm also thinking of 19-episode Alfred Hitchcock Presents Norman Lloyd. I'm thinking of him as a prime collaborator. I'm thinking of Roald Dahl, who wrote several of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents Who Hitchcock Worshipped and used a lot of his humor in his films and episodes. And then you think of even... When you talk of collaborating, you also think of the person who Hitchcock identified in different interviews as the person, male or female, actor, actress, that he loved. He was the only person he loved more than any other, and that, of course, is Cary Grant. So he's a collaborator. I guess it depends on how you take the word collaborator. But his wife, of course, was you know, she was his guardian angel. She wrote for him. She was his secretary. She basically, you know, he wouldn't have been where he was without her. The other contributions speak for themselves. They're right up there with Herman and some of the other ones you mentioned.
You know, I think Sammy wins by mentioning Alma.
Yes. No, I'm glad he did, because he saved me from having to mention, you know, because I was going to go with Herman as far as on the, you know, the one side of things, but then I was like, damn, there's Alma, but maybe someone will choose Alma, and then I saw that, you know, Aaron didn't, and you didn't, and then I was like, well, if Sammy doesn't, I guess I'm going to have to. So I'm glad he mentioned her.
It's funny because I very stupidly didn't even think of mentioning Alma, and because her work is so much behind the scenes. But, you know, she is so centrally important, just as Sammy says.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm going to have to ask this question. What is our least favorite Hitchcock movie? Aaron said simply, L Street Calling. I don't ever want to even think about it again. So what about you, Sammy? What's your least favorite Hitchcock movie? The one that you're like, okay, I saw it. Why did I see it? Why did I waste 2 hours of my life?
Well, you know, taking out of this equation the first few silent films, which I don't think it would be fair, just as he was, you know, setting out as a director, it wouldn't be fair to mention those first two or three, even though you had the first edition of Blackmail among them. But I'm just saying in general terms, you'd have to go further to find it. I know, and I think Cindy mentioned that she liked it, but Hitchcock didn't like Juno and the Paycock, which is based on one of the greatest plays of Irish literature, Casey. But that's his issue. I don't find it among the worst films. But I'm going to, and you know, the Paradine case, of course, is one that the haters like to point out. But the one that never really got me completely, and yet there are fans there are fans that few of them love the film, but I think there are more haters. I would side with the haters, but I haven't watched the movie for so many years that I would need to go back at it to really put a real takedown of it. But it was an Australian love triangle. I guess you know what I'm talking about at this point. Under Capricorn, it didn't work. It was, you know, stilted. It was superficial. It was overlong for what it was. It was ponderous. It was very talky. And again, I would have to look at it again, but those were my original feelings about it. It wasn't devoid of some elements, of some good scenes, of some good craftsmanship. But as a whole, it didn't work. And again, there's very few Hitchcock movies that I could say that about. You know, there's probably, and I love Ingmar Bergman. There's probably more bad Ingmar Bergman movies than there are Hitchcock movies, especially the very earliest ones. You know, that would be my choice. I don't know what, you know, you're going to say, what Cindy's going to say. You may have a completely different choice here, but that one, Rich and Strange, 1931, wasn't one I would, you know, that I would consider that to make the, you know, the list of least impressive. But I don't want to say any more because that means I'm hogging all the potential choices, so I'm not going to say any more.
Well, you know, he did make a lot of movies that are just kind of bleh. But, you know, when you make that many movies, there's going to be a bunch that you just don't like, even if you think, okay, it's okay, I just don't like it. You know, doing this as you did and saying, you know, ignoring some of the very early stuff, some of his nascent work, I'm going to go with two of his later movies. And I know this is going to cause shit when I say this, because the one movie seems to be beloved by a certain section of people, and the other one is kind of people are just kind of indifferent. Now, I'm not saying these are necessarily his worst movies. Remember, this is the one that I said our least favorite. Torn Curtain, which has all the elements to be wonderful, including, you know, that cast. I mean, Paul Newman, Julie Andrews, just as your leads, and yet it's boring as fuck for me. And then there's Marnie, which, my wife and I watched it together. My wife actually said, do we have to finish this? And I said, yeah, for the show in June, I really need to sit through and watch the whole thing. I will say that I have not seen a lot of movies actually make my wife angry. You know, there are times where she plays like they do, or a scene in a movie upsets her, but not the film itself. That film as a whole upset her. And, you know, do I think it's a bad movie? You know, sometimes I think there are parts of it that are bad. Did I enjoy it more than she did? Oh, undoubtedly. But is it one that I enjoyed? Is it a least favorite? You know, I don't think I will ever go back to it. I had some similar problems to with the film as my wife did. So, yeah, for me, it's really two films. It's Torn Curtain and Marnie. And, you know, it's interesting. They were made back-to-back, so I don't know what the fuck was going on with Hitchcock at that point. those are two of my very least favorite Hitchcock films. So, Cindy, yours?
Okay, I wanted to cheat at first and pick one of the early films that nobody except Hitchcock aficionados have heard of. So, you know, my first temptation was to pick like The Manx Man or Richard Strange or Champagne or something like that. But then I thought about it and I thought, no, I need to be a little more provocative. So I would have to say that probably my least favorite, and no, it's not Marnie at all, but my least favorite of the Hitchcock films that are worth really, you know, focusing your ire on is probably Rope. And I know that some people really, really love it. But for me, the issues are, first of all, I know that it's based upon Leopold and Loeb and that they were dealing with the intermention theory and all of that other kind of stuff. But for me, it just reads like bad Crime and Punishment. So, you know, it's and I've written extensively on Crime and Punishment, the Dostoevsky novel. So it was, it just didn't work for me. And it's probably a me issue more than the film issue, but it really didn't work for me. And I think it's also one of the films that's less cinematic. So, and you know, I didn't
wait,
even
wait, no,
really,
you,
huh?
No, I just before I forget, you brought something, and it's about how familiar you are with Dostoevsky, and you saw the influences there. Keep that in mind when you're done and remind me of that. I have a comment to make that goes along with this, so please continue.
Okay, and I know that Hitchcock is not deliberately using Crime and Punishment, okay? He's using deliberately Leopold and Loeb, but what I was reading into it was Crime and Punishment, you know, because it's so parallel. I mean, the theory behind the murder is the same and all of that kind of stuff. And so that it just didn't work for me because, you know, Crime and Punishment is such an amazing, 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 amazing novel. And Rope just paled in comparison to it. So I think that if Hitchcock had made a movie that compared to Crime and Punishment, it would have worked a lot better for me. Because it's not just simply that it's dealing with the same thematic material. It's just that it doesn't do it as amazingly as Crime and Punishment does. But that's my main thing.
Is that Severus?
You know, that's Minerva, actually. Minerva is the one who... Yeah, Minerva is the little show-off, and she wants attention right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so you wanted to be reminded of Dostoevsky, I think?
Well, no, it's this. There's a show that just finished, Succession. Got a lot of acclaim, won a lot of awards, has a lot of people thinking it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. There's never been anything as enjoyable as this since the invention of the orgasm. But as someone who's seen a lot of movies, read a lot of books, is very familiar with where this is coming from, where they're drawing their inspiration from, and knows what the writers have done before, and has seen, oh Jesus, at this point probably thousands of TV programs. You know, when I'm faced with someone who has seen perhaps 30 or 40 TV shows in their very brief lives, and they want to call Succession the greatest drama ever devised for film or television, I can't help but laugh and feel, yeah, but, you know, it was okay. I saw season one. I didn't feel the need to continue. Maybe it gets better. I don't know, but I don't give a fuck if it has Brian Cox in it. I've seen this before, and it feels like it's covering the same material as I've seen in many other shows, you know, at its base. You know, it may be dressed up differently, but it's ultimately the same thing I've seen in other better shows. And I can't help but think that that's kind of how you feel about Rope, you know?
Probably, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I also recognize that Hitchcock was trying a technical experiment in the film. So I do know that, but it just doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
You're hardly alone. You're hardly alone with your sentiments on Rope. There's many that can't stand it. It's a very divisive movie.
Yeah, and so is Marnie, and Adam and I are on different sides of Marnie.
Right. I tend to be on your side on Marnie and on Rope. I'm pretty close to where you are.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now we will come to we'll get to the films themselves, the top 10 countdown, and do a little discussion there. But you know, really, where do we rank Hitchcock? You know, where do we put him all time? You know, for me, if he's not in my top 10, he's right outside it, like 11 or 12. But I'm at one of those points where I don't know if I can necessarily give a very specific, he's right here at number 3, or he's right there at number 11 or 12. It's easier for me to do that with movies and shows and writers. But, you know, with directors, I've always had a little harder time ranking them. I mean, Billy Wilder is my favorite writer-director, but that doesn't necessarily mean that if you ask me who's the best, would he still be number one? Because that's a different question, you know? But where would we rank, where would we put Hitchcock, Cindy?
Okay, a lot depends upon the criteria we're using, as you mentioned. You know, are we talking about best or most significant to the history of cinema or what? And I think if we're talking about his importance, he's in the top 2 or 3. I mean, seriously, he really is. There is really very little cinema without Alfred Hitchcock. In terms of best, he's certainly in the top 5 to 10, I think. You know, so, and I know that we tend to look at film directors who are more, I mean, I love, as you know, Sammy said, Bergman, and Kurosawa, and those guys are really, really great filmmakers. And I would say that he's in their class in terms of quality, but he tends to be more of a popular filmmaker, you know, that his films are trying to reach the audience and really put the audience at the forefront. And that may be why he might not be taken as seriously as somebody like Tarkovsky or whatever, you know.
I was just thinking about something that you just said, and I did a show last year on him, and that's on John Ford. And, you know, John Ford was a very popular director, but while John Ford loved his movies to make money, he also, maybe more than Hitchcock, made those movies for himself. Now, that's not to say that he was any more or less of an auteur than Hitchcock may or may not have been, but I do think that there's a reason that Hitchcock's movies have remained as popular as they are. And you're right, he did design them to be entertainment in ways that, you know, even an old curmudgeon like John Ford would never admit to his films being more than entertainment, but they were. You know, now are those two, you know, trying to do what Tarkovsky was trying to do, or even what Kurosawa, who was Ford influenced, or Bergman were trying to do? No, but that's fine. You know, it's great to have different things out there to enjoy.
Yeah.
So.
And the other thing is, temperamentally, Hitchcock's an extrovert, not an introvert, and I think that comes out in his cinema. And so it's, you know, it's not as internal. It's more manifested externally. You do see the obsession. You do see the psychological elements, but they're frequently manifested in plot. And so it's he does an interesting balancing act.
Yes, yes. So now I will. So Sammy, what about you? Where do you rank Hitchcock?
Well, he, remember, he's an entertainment icon. He's unlike all these other film directors. He had the television shows. He was a major influence on the not only the advent, but the maturation of television as a medium. He was all over Good Evening, you know, his cameos, his profile. I mean, he was a larger-than-life character. So when you ask me where does he rank, we have to consider all those other things. The television preeminence, you know, the prolific filmography, where, as Alan Fish notably said, he had more masterpieces than any other director, for whatever that means and whatever that's worth, but it means something. May have had some bad films. He had more stone-cold masterpieces than any director. Is he my personal favorite? Because your question does go into personal feelings. My favorite directors are Bergman, Bresson, Ozu, Chaplin, and Murnau. Those are my five favorite directors in no particular order. The other day, I would have told you Chaplin was number one. Today, maybe Bergman's number one. So Bresson, Ozu, and whoever else I just mentioned, I'm losing my thought, train of thought. But where would Hitchcock would be fair game for me for the number six slot if I wrote my favorite directors. He would be fair game for the number six slot. But you're asking me and Cindy and Aaron and yourself, if you ask 500 film fans that question, Hitchcock's going to come number one in my opinion. He's going to come number one in the opinions of most people. He's going to wind up being the number one favorite director for all the reasons that we discussed and what I just added there. But we happen to have a little group here that we have our certain opinions, you know, our preferences, so maybe we wouldn't put him there. You have him outside the top 10. Cindy has him approximately
said,
in the middle of the
maybe.
Top 10.
I said maybe. I don't know.
Like
I said, it's possible
okay.
I can have him outside. I said it's
right.
Possible.
Yeah,
like I said,
Ford
I don't
would
know.
Be even with him in that sense. That we had that show about Ford a few months ago. If I would rate Ford, another prolific American director of the highest stature, roughly even with Hitchcock, you know, in terms of greatness. And if you take those personal favorites of mine out of the mix, then he would reign right near the top. He has to rank for so many reasons: his influence, the number of films he made, the great films, all the different. I mean, ironically, his films were. No, it doesn't speak well for the Academy Awards. Only one of his performers ever won an Academy Award. That's a trivia question. Somebody can answer that. Who was the only Hitchcock actor or actress to win an Academy Award in any of his films? Only one in his whole career. It's easy to Google, though, but I just figured someone might know it. I just happened to come upon that looking before.
So now we come to the part where we're going to get to discuss the films a little bit. We're going to do this. Excuse me. We're going to do this in the style of the old Siskel and Ebert countdowns, where we're each going to rank our number 10, then number 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You know, once again, we're going to let ladies go first. So, Cindy, what is your number 10 Hitchcock movie?
Well, as you know, Adam, I don't rank movies. So I have a top 10. Actually, it's kind of a top 11. But I do have a top 10. And what I'm doing is a little bit different, because what I'm going to try to do is have at least one representative of each Hitchcock major decade. So, and I'm going to do it chronologically. So my first film.
And that's fine. So this can act as your number 10 and then so on and so forth. That's perfectly
Except
acceptable.
It may not be my number 10 film, but
it's like I said, it doesn't matter, just as long as we can do this.
Yes, I will do it. My first film that I'm going to talk about is The Lodger from 1926, 27. I mean, it first got its screening in 26, but it was released in 27. And, you know, I think that it's kind of interesting. I've had an interesting journey with The Lodger, because I was originally looking at The Lodger from the perspective of somebody who was writing on Jack the Ripper cinema. And as we know, Hitchcock was required, because of Ivor Novello's popularity, to change the guilt of The Lodger from Bella Clown's novel. But anyway, one of the things that I found interesting is the first time I saw the film, it was in a scratchy black and white print with a dreary, dreary, dreary organ score. And I recently saw eventually I found one with a good score, but this time I saw the Criterion version, which is a beautiful restored blue tint, yeah. Sepia tint, red tint.
Gorgeous.
print with a re-recorded score that's beautifully mastered, placed high in the mix of the film. And really, oh my gosh, that version of the film is actually a masterpiece. If you see The Lodger in the Criterion version, I believe that it really is a masterwork. His career starts, you know, for all practical purposes, his career starts with The Lodger, and it's the first film
that
was shown under
his name.
That's
why I have The Lodger at number 10. It is a film that I don't exactly love, but it's so undeniably well made. And every time I watch it, I learn to appreciate a little more. I don't think I'll ever love it, but I learn to appreciate it a little more. I have a similar deal with 2001, but it's remarkable filmmaking, particularly for that time, you know. So, Sammy, what is your number 10?
All right, this is where I cheated like Cindy did. She made an admission she has a top 11. Well, so do I. And there's a tie for number 10. So it's not really that bad of a cheat, because if you have it at the very bottom, the tie, I guess, is acceptable. One of them is The Wrong Man, which is Hitchcock's play on Vittorio De Sica in Italian neorealism. And it's certainly, you know, it's so far different than anything he ever made. We've all seen the film, and, you know, he took a swipe at that particular type of film, and, you know, it was just brilliantly made and acted. The tie is with I Confess, which is, I continue to think, is the most underrated Hitchcock film, with Montgomery Clift, you know, having a priest, you know, keep information, you know, that he's supposed to tell, but then by the, you know, by the Catholic rules, you know, you have to keep quiet, you have to keep this information to yourself. It's a brilliantly made, brooding film with one of Cliff's best performances as the priest. I don't see why there are some film fans that are cold to the film. I find it riveting, haunting, you know, it's one of his best films. It ties for the number 10 spot on my list, and, you know, I could watch that film anytime. I am Catholic, but I'm not a, you know, every Sunday type of Catholic, but I could see the aspects of the faith that it woven into the film that are very effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, Aaron's among his top 10, and his number 10 is The 39 Steps, but the 1935 version. The 1935 version. So what is your number 9? Cindy, or rather your next choice, but we're going to call it number 9.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, my next choice is the 1934 Man Who Knew Too Much. And the reasons are that basically this film, I don't think that there is a more important film in Hitchcock's history. Not necessarily best or anything like that. It's definitely not one of his very, very, very best films. But it's the first film where we really start to see his voice come out in the sound era. And also it broke the doldrums that his career was in. It established him, you know, in the British cinema, and it made a big splash in America. It was the first film that was ever screened for the British royal couple, the King and Queen. It was the first private screening ever, was The Man Who Knew Too Much. And it also really established that dark humor that you have in the midst of crisis. I know that he had done that in earlier films, but, you know, this really played that up to the hilt. I mean, with the, you know, they're like, you know, hitting each other with chairs in the Temple of the Sun or whatever the name of that place is. And, you know, there's just so much really great humor in it. And I also love the fact that the wife is a sharpshooter and that she's the one who takes down the killer or the assassin, the proposed killer. So, I mean, I think it's really a fun film. I think it's a very important film for Hitchcock's career. And, you know, it's arguably the film that made it possible for Hitchcock to continue, you know, moving in the direction that he moved in towards greatness.
Mm-hmm. Well, Aaron has Foreign Correspondent as his number 9. Myself, I probably am going to catch it from you. Rope. I've got Rope in that. I do like Rope. I think it's like the most amazing thing ever? No, but is it a lot of fun? Oh yeah, I have a lot of fun with it. But you guys may be shocked by something that's coming up. Which I think treads in some similar territory as Rope, but is much more playful and a much better film. So, Sammy, what is your number 9?
Number 9 would be the kind of Hitchcock's version of Charles Laughton's The Night of the Hunter, Shadow of a Doubt, which happens to be Hitch's favorite film. He's made that statement many times in interviews, I think even with Truffaut, that was his favorite film, Shadow of a Doubt. Certainly a great film. And, you know, it, no other film of his plays that hero-villain dynamic quite as well as that film. And it is expertly made and timed and written and scored and photographed. It's certainly a high-quality film, and it's extremely entertaining, and it will probably place in many, many top 10 Hitchcocks. I know there are some people would have it a lot higher than that. They'd have it even in the top 3 or 4, but that's where I placed it at number 9.
Yep. 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 Now, I guess we're on to our number 8.
Yeah,
because as I said, you know, Aaron, his number 9 was Foreign Correspondent. And my number 8, we'll start with my number 8. And my number 8 is Suspicion. Sorry, I said Suspicion, but I meant to say Spellbound. It is Spellbound. And Aaron's number 8 is Shadow of a Doubt. So, Cindy, what is your number 8?
Well, my next film is The 39 Steps, 1935. In that film, I think that's probably Hitchcock's first sound masterpiece. It's where everything really comes together. All of the stuff that we see percolating in The Man Who Knew Too Much really comes together, and Hitchcock really starts to hit his stride with The 39 Steps. So I think it's a really, you know, terrific film. It's got a great chase. It's got, you know, just it's got a good plot. It's riveting. It just keeps the audience going on the edge of their seats. It's just a really terrific film.
It is. Certainly.
Sammy?
And I would have the other big British film of that era as my number eight, The Lady Vanishes, which I think Adam loves. Dame Mae Whitty. It has just the right blend of humor, of excitement, of mystery. It's beautifully filmed. It's an irresistible film. And certainly when you talk about pure entertainment, you know, that film will always be a favorite. I remember we took a poll not long ago of the best supporting actresses of 1938, and by a landslide, that our voters said that it was Dame Mae Whitty in The Lady Vanishes. And I applauded that choice. It's my favorite British film of his, although I certainly love The 39 Steps of the Man Who Knew Too Much and The Lodger, and regret not fitting those three into my top 10. But my favorite of them is The Lady Vanishes.
So now we're to number seven. And my number seven is Rebecca. My number seven is Rebecca. Aaron's number seven is the 1934 version of The Man Who Knew Too Much. So, Cindy, what is your number seven?
Rebecca. And, you know, one of the key reasons, I believe, is that it's the film that makes the transition from the British period into the American period. And it's, you know, really well done, even if it's not what Hitchcock might have thought of as totally Hitchcock. It's a great film. It just really is. I watched it again yesterday and was just as impressed as I was before. It's just terrific.
It really is.
And you're right. You're right about Mrs. Danvers, by the way. In fact, I was calling her the prototype for all the nannies from hell, even though she's not a nanny, you know.
Ah, but she is.
Yeah, really. I mean, you know, she's misery. She's the nanny. She's, you know.
Well, you know, speaking of misery, Stephen King was asked, where did you get the idea for that character in Misery? He said, well, you know, there's Rebecca, among other things.
So my instincts were right. I didn't actually know King had said that, but yeah.
No, he's great. Sammy?
Number seven. Well, this is a film that I'm sure it's going to be mentioned by all of you at some point, probably higher, obviously, since I haven't heard it yet. But for me, it's number seven, Notorious. There's not too much to say. I mean, the crane shot with the key and the performances of, you know, that was the one year Claude Rains, also in Casablanca, where he should have won the Oscar for his performance in Notorious, but then that was the year they had sympathy for Harold Russell in The Best Years of Our Lives. But looking back on Rains' career, that was certainly one of his greatest performances. But, of course, the leads were great. And, you know, it was expert Hitchcock. Hitchcock written all over the film. It's just a class act in every department. And it's one of the films that people will pick up and rewatch probably as often as any of his films. And, as I say, as you count this down, I'm expecting it's going to come, but I could be wrong on your lists to come. With me, it was number 7.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, number 6. And this is going to be one where I think this is going to throw you guys for a huge loop. Aaron's number
Mr.
6
and Mrs.
is
Smith.
is Spellbound. My number 6 is The Trouble with Harry.
Oh, wow.
I think it's an utter fucking delight. I don't care about the hate it gets. I love it. Fuck the haters. fuck the haters. So Cindy.
Okay, I need to rewatch The Trouble with Harry. I did not like it the first time I saw it, but I do need to rewatch it. And I think the reason I didn't like it was because it was so far out of what I expected from Hitchcock. So I really do need to give it another viewing.
For me, it's one of those movies where that dark humor really comes through.
Yeah, yeah. And you have mentioned the dark humor a couple of times, so I know that that's really part of your core experience of Hitchcock. So it makes total sense that you would go with The Trouble with Harry. Okay, so I ran into a problem with my 40s decade because I've got Rebecca, and then there's this whole big list of movies from the 40s, most of which are very, very good, and that I didn't have time to rewatch. I really love Spellbound, and, you know, I really admire Shadow of a Doubt. But I decided to go for what I think is the best of all Hitchcock's 40s movies, except that it was made in 1951.
Oh, I know what it is.
Yeah,
I know,
Strangers
on a
Train.
I got the same one. I got the same one for that position, yep.
Yeah, so it's Strangers on a Train.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, that is more like his 40s movies than his 50s movies. It's got so much psychodrama. It's incredible. And, you know, it does all those things Hitchcock does, you know, with getting this ordinary guy caught up in this weird thing. But in this case, it's not a spy drama, you know. It's just this psycho guy, you know, who wants murder done. So, I mean, I really love that one.
Yep. Yep. Sammy?
Yeah, that's my number 6. As I just said, we put it right. We spoke of it at the same time. I can only add, and Cindy said everything. Yes, psychodrama, you know, the tension, you know, I would go as far as to say that Robert Walker gave the greatest performance of an actor or an actress in any Hitchcock film in Hitchcock's entire run of the cinema. I would have Robert Walker. And in 1951, the year the film came out, for me it would be Walker and Alistair Sim for A Christmas Carol as that year's best actor. But that has nothing to do with Hitchcock. I'm just saying that
as an aside. Oh, but I love Alistair Sim's Christmas Carol. It's my favorite Christmas Carol.
Well, I'm glad to hear that too. But yeah, no, Strangers on a Train is you know, that's the high grade Hitchcock. Number 6 for both of us.
And I think that you're
number
right.
Number five is where I have my tie.
Okay.
and that is where I put Notorious. And Strangers on a Train.
What is
I have,
it?
I have Notorious and Strangers. I have Notorious and Strangers on a Train tied at 5. Aaron, however, has just Notorious at 5. So, what about you, Cindy? What's your next one?
Rear Window.
Ooh, really good.
I love Rear Window, and, you know, I was part of that audience in the 80s that got to see it when it was finally re-released, and, you know, we could see the film again. I remember the first time I saw it was sitting on the floor of, you know, a room in the student union building at my college campus. They didn't show it on the big theater. They showed it, you know, in this little room. But we were just packed in there, and we were watching this movie that nobody had seen in, like, decades, right? And it was very exciting. But the film itself stands up on subsequent viewings. So it's not just that first experience. It's also the experience of all of those little vignettes and the murder drama and you know, the suspicion, the growing suspicion. And what's really interesting to me about that film, you know, I was telling my husband tonight, in that film, it's like you've got Robert Altman's entire career, you know, with all those little vignettes, with all those different characters, and Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. You know, you've got those sorts of things. Those influences are taking place right there in that film, too.
So, Sammy?
My number five, again, this is one that hasn't been mentioned yet, which means that both of you and Aaron, whatever, are probably going to have it in the top three or four, or even though Cindy's not doing those numerically, but still, is North by Northwest. I mean, you have, you know, Cary Grant, Eva Marie Saint, James Mason, the crop dusting and the Mount Rushmore and all the mysterious goings-on in that house on the hill. It's just, you know, it's justly famous as one of Hitchcock's greatest masterpieces, Bernard Herrmann. There's just so much in that film in terms of mood and atmosphere. It has an impeccably brilliant plot. No discussion of Hitchcock would be, you know, complete without, you know, a thorough examination of that film from all angles. And I feel guilty that I'm putting it at number five, when in truth it should be even higher. But, you know, numerical is very, very difficult, and it's how you feel that particular day. Right today I happen to feel four other films rate slightly higher than North by Northwest.
Yep.
Okay.
Well,
proceed.
Well, Aaron's number four was Psycho. My number four is Rear Window. Cindy?
Okay. This is where I'm going to get pushback because, as you know, I'm doing it chronologically. And my next choice is North by Northwest, which you know what that means. It means I just left out Vertigo. Now, yep. I don't dislike Vertigo. I do admire the film. But I'm not passionate about the film. The film is one of those films that I don't come back to over and over and over again like I do these other films. So my next film is North by Northwest for just like all the reasons Sammy was saying. I think it's got an incredible musical score, too. It's just such a great film. And it's, you know, Hitchcock had this theory about envisioning the places that you wanted the film to be set, and he did that with The Man Who Knew Too Much, or he claimed he did. You know, he wanted the Swiss Alps, he wanted the East End of London, he wanted a concert in the Albert Hall, and then created a plot to connect them. Well, North by Northwest, is similar in that regard, but it's just so well realized, and it's kind of like, even though it's not the 39 Steps, it's kind of like the apotheosis of what the 39 Steps was doing. So that's my
yep.
my choice.
Yeah. Sammy?
My number four is Rebecca. I have it higher than anyone else has put the film. It's a flawless entertainment masterpiece. No, it's not Hitchcock, but that's okay. Hitchcock can do something different. Hitchcock can collaborate with Selznick. And he can bring together Olivier and Fontaine and Anderson and all the rest of them, even Edith Van Hopper in that wonderful comic bit as the servant lady who's, pulling Fontaine all around. She had some of the film's funniest lines. But then it's a brooding masterpiece, you know, by the window and Anderson almost, you know, urging her to commit suicide and the courtroom scene. Masterful entertainment based on a potboiler novel that was justly famous. And as I mentioned earlier in this hour, I talked about George Barnes and Franz Waxman, who gave Rebecca, you know, artistic heft in the other departments. It's just a great follow-up to Gone with the Wind for Selznick, and it won Best Picture, the only Hitchcock film to win Best Picture. But I don't want to keep bringing up the idiots at Academy Awards as if that means anything. But I'm just using it for perspective. I mean, it did win all kinds of awards. The New York Film Critics, I believe, may have even given Hitchcock their Best Director that year, which it was thrown. The Academy went with John Ford for The Grapes of Wrath, but they gave Rebecca the Best Picture. I still think it holds up. 1940 and all, with the American output just to her, all of it, I still feel it holds up as one of his absolute masterpieces, and that's why I got it at number four.
Yep. Well, so number three, Aaron has Vertigo. And, you know, this is where I was very tempted to have a tie, so I'm going to. I'm going to tie it, but it's going to be a tie that people may say, oh, you're cheating here. Maybe I am. The remake of The Man Who Knew Too Much, because I think Doris Day is amazing, honestly, in that film. I really do think that she's wonderful. It's not just Que Sera Sera, but also North by Northwest. Like I said, Aaron had Vertigo here. So, where do I have Vertigo? So, before we go to our top three, because I think that we may end up going into overtime here, and that means that we probably will end up having just a few minutes discussion after 10 o'clock. So for those of you following along live, you will get to hear the end of the conversation, but you'll have to wait probably about 15, 20 minutes before it becomes available on Blog Talk, because that's how long it takes to process an episode. But I need to do the announcements. I do not have, unfortunately, the full announcement list for what's coming up across all of Blog Talk. But what I do have is what's coming up on this show here, on Cathode Ray Mission. So with apologies to my fellow Deviant Legionnaires, I am going to say that what's coming up, sorry guys, I just don't have it in front of me. It's not letting me access that information tonight. So what's coming up on Cathode Ray Mission in one week from tonight on June 9th, is a look at the recently concluded series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. 1 week after that, on June 16th, we will be taking a look at the also recently concluded series, Barry. And if you notice something, yes, we're back to a weekly schedule because it's summer, and this will continue through August. We're going to have actually a pretty full schedule through September and October. There's not going to be a lot of time off the next 4 months or so. It's going to be pretty packed next 16 weeks. I think I've only got maybe two or three weeks off in that, so this is going to be a big run, you know, just huge run, guys. So I hope you will, of course, join us for those, you listeners out there. So now back to our discussion. So, yes, Cindy, what is your number three?
The next one is Psycho, which is always towards the top of my Hitchcock lists anyway. I have a handful of very, very favorite Hitchcock movies, and this is one of them. I mean, I just love everything about it, from the beautiful black and white to the Bernard Herrmann score to the way that Hitchcock manipulated, Hitchcock and Stefano manipulated Robert Bloch's novel, which I have read, and which is, you know, it's like Hitchcock really did Bloch a favor, whether Bloch knew it or not, because the film is incredible. And I just, you know, I love Psycho. One of my very top ones.
Mm-hmm. So, my number three. Oh, no, sorry. Yeah, my number three. And this is going to probably shock people. It's Foreign Correspondent. I think it's that fucking amazing. I think it is that fucking amazing. I really, really do. I think it's phenomenal. You know, so shadow of a doubt. But what about you, Sammy? What's your number three?
Well, even though Cindy's doing her list chronologically, once again we coincide. Psycho is my number three. I can't say much. You know, Perkins gave one of the great male performances of all time. Certainly one to consider against Robert Walker's in Strangers on the Train, and all of the supporting players were brilliant. Never before has chocolate sauce been used as such a provocative prop in a film. And I'll just leave it at that. It's one of the greatest horror movies of all time, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Well, that wraps us up to number two very quickly. Aaron's number two was Strangers on a Train. My number two is Psycho. So what is your number two, Cindy?
Okay, this is where I get provocative. I rewatched Marnie today, and I went in afterwards and told Brian, I wish I hadn't seen it because it just screwed up my list. My number two, my next one is a mid-60s tie, or a sort of mid-60s tie, with The Birds and Marnie, to be honest. I think The Birds is actually my favorite Hitchcock film. You know, I just think it's incredibly brilliant, but Marnie is starting to vie for that spot. And I'm sorry, but it doesn't make me mad. I think it's just an incredible performance by Tippi Hedren. If we thought she was wooden in The Birds, she's not wooden in Marnie. And I understand that there are issues with the Sean Connery character, but I think that the psychodrama is really well realized. I think it's Hitchcock's best delving into some real psychological drama and trauma and all of that. And I don't know, I was just amazed at how good I thought it was when I rewatched it today. I'd only seen it once before and needed to watch it again, and watched it this afternoon and said, oh my gosh, this just screwed up my list. So that's my tie. It's The Birds and Marnie. Sorry, Adam.
No, it's fine. It's fine. So, Sammy?
We're at number two, right?
Yep.
Yeah, number two. My number two is Rear Window, which is, again, it's a staggering masterpiece. It's one of the greatest American movies of the 1950s. It features Stewart and Kelly and that great set, you know, witnessing a murder and, you know, looking from the window, and then Raymond Burr committing the murder. It's just one of Hitchcock's. And that, by the way, he said in interviews that was one of his personal favorite movies, right near the top of his own list. Shadow of a Doubt seems to be the one that's mentioned most often, but he did love Rear Window a lot, too. And
Rear Window's
of
amazing.
Course, critics, Rear Window is always near the top of critics' list, but that's not why I chose it. You're asking us for personal connections, and, you know, there's so many reasons why Rear Window should be on my list anyway in the top two. So that's the way I stand on it.
So now we come to our top selections. Aaron's number one is Rear Window. So, Cindy, what is your number one?
Okay, well, it's actually not my number one, but it's
I know,
the,
but your most recent great.
Hold on, I need to change phones here. Okay, good. I'm going to turn the other phone off. It was running out of battery. I'm still here, right?
Yeah, you are.
Well,
okay, great. Okay, so the last great Hitchcock film, in my opinion, is from 1972, so I have represented all the decades, and it's Frenzy.
Oh, Frenzy is a good one. I need to revisit that one. That is one that I did not, I will admit, in my run-up and watching so many Hitchcock movies, I just didn't get around to revisiting that one.
Yeah, I made a point of revisiting it because I knew that I was going to do a decades thing. So, you know, I wanted to make sure that Frenzy fit the list, and it does. It stands up there with the rest of the films on my list, I believe.
And my number one, I'll let my number one be the last one. So, Sammy, what about you? Sorry.
Well, it's Vertigo. It's Vertigo. There's no question. It's one of the greatest films
in
the history of the cinema. Yeah, it's one of the greatest films in the history of the cinema. But I did take into account what Cindy said. I know this is all, you know, from a, you know, it's personal, it's taste, a number of things. And there's so many reasons why I could say why it's Vertigo, but you'd need a whole other show, and as others who would argue their number one choice or a film of that pedigree. But it's just such a staggering masterpiece. There's so many reasons. It's in my opinion, it's and I know I'm going with the hordes, the Sight and Sound crowd. 10 years ago, they called it the greatest film ever made until it was usurped by, of all films, Jeannie Dielman. But that's another story for another day. I'm going to say Vertigo is his greatest masterpiece, or my favorite of his films.
No, it's a terrific film. It really, really is. You know, it's got my, if not my favorite, I don't know if I would call it my favorite Jimmy Stewart performance, but it could be the one that when I first saw it ages ago, it made me reevaluate him as an actor. Do I think it's his best performance? Maybe. I'm not going to say for sure, but it could be. And then, of course, as we said earlier, that Bernard Herrmann score. Good Lord.
Did you say it was your number one film, Vertigo? Is that your number one? Well, you didn't.
That's
say
my
it.
Number one for Hitchcock. Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yes. No, that's why I said there. We go. We're in agreement. But we have come down to the end of the show. So you know, I want, and we did it in under 2 hours. So I want to, you know, thank everybody out there for listening. I want to thank you two for coming in and participating. Now, however, is there anything that maybe will take about, say, 10 seconds, because it's about all the time we've got?
Oh, no. I should probably add what I have then to, you know, just chat functions or whatever, because I actually have a really cool thing from the London Times Review of The Lodger, and what's interesting about it is that the paper did not recognize that films were not ephemeral, and believed that there was no drama in the film because we can't forget that June is June and Novello is Novello, and that on the screen nothing bad can ever happen to either of these two, so we knew that he wasn't the killer. And I thought that was so interesting because I saw the movie in the 90s. I had no idea who June or Novello were. And, you know, I found that very interesting because it shows the attitude of the British cinema in 1926 when Hitchcock hit the scene. And it shows that, you know, they didn't really realize that this was an art form that would stand the test of time and that generations 70, 80, almost 100 years later would be watching this movie and not really knowing much about the actors.
Yep. And I think that sums up Hitchcock. So once again, I will say before we go, thank you all for listening. Thank you for coming in. And with less than 10 seconds to go, on the count of three, we will say good night. One, two, three. Good night, folks.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Good night. Thank you.